Today's Teisho is on Case 53, Hyakujo, and a Wild Duck. Engo's Introduction. The universe is not veiled. All its activities lie open. Whichever way he may go, he meets no obstruction. At all times he behaves independently. His every word is devoid of egocentricity, yet still has the power to kill others. Tell me, where did the ancient worthy come to rest? See the following. Main subject. When Ba Daishi, Matsu, was out walking with Hyakujo, he saw a wild duck fly past. Daishi said, "What is it?" Hyakujo said, "It is a wild duck." Daishi said, "Where is it?" Hyakujo said, "It has flown away." Daishi at last gave Hyakujo's nose a sharp pinch. Hyakujo cried out with pain. Daishi said, "There, how can it fly away?" Secho's verse, a wild duck. What, how, and where? Basso has seen, talked, taught, and exhausted the meaning of mountain clouds and moonlit seas, but Joe doesn't understand, has flown away. This is the third day of our August Sesshin, and everybody did a wonderful job this morning in the Zendo. It was really very still. It was quite remarkable. Even though there's many challenges, right? I mean, it's tired, pain in your legs, heat. And yet, you know, people sat very still. It was really wonderful. Of course, maybe "and yet" is not right, yeah? Because of those things, we can use those things to deepen our practice and enter this very, very deep mind. And so all of these things contributed to make the sitting so deep this morning. And it was really wonderful. Really, everybody's doing a wonderful job. A little while ago, Jane may have had heat, overcome by heat, or may have other physical problems. I'm very glad we have a number of health professionals here. I feel very reassured since I don't know anything about these matters, and she's on her way, I think, maybe going to see a doctor now. That's part of life, yeah. I mean, it just is. You know, we really do try to screen out a great deal of life, you know. I'll never forget when my father died. My sister is a nurse, and she actually works in an oncology ward. That's her specialty. So she mostly works with people who are on their way out, and that's her specialty too, working with people who probably aren't going to make it. And she's a really wonderful person, really wonderful. And at any rate, when my dad died, it was on a day like today. It was very hot. It was actually in July. And he had been sick for a number of years, and with cancer, he had cancer. And last day his life, you know, I was fortunate enough to be there. And then after a while he died. And everybody, we all got up, and my brother and my sister and I, we all felt we needed to get out of the house and just walk around. So we went for a walk, you know, like 2 hours. And when we came back, I wanted to take another look at my dad's body, but my sister had already arranged for it to be taken away. And I was so disappointed. I love my sister, but I was looking forward to being able to sit there and take it in, you know. And it was like my father was whisked away. And it was like, then it was gone, you know. And in fact, the bed was made, you know. And my sister's intentions were really good, you know. She had really good intentions. But she was really trying to protect everybody from something that's basically part of life, you know. Really, basically, just part of life. And it's important to have, like, a big picture, I think. We really don't allow things like death to have much of a place in the modern world, you know, I would say. In ancient times, you know, it wouldn't be necessarily unusual to, run across a dead cow on the road, or even a dead person. You know, that wasn't so... A great Zen master once found his mother's body out in the field, you know, one day. This was quite common. You know, this wasn't like an extraordinary event. People had a different relationship with mortality, with their limitation. And fragility and vulnerability and so on. And what we've decided to do instead is to very carefully control reality so that we don't encounter these too much. That I think we're very impoverished by this, you know. Basically everybody in this room is going to have get sick. Is going to have a heart attack or a stroke or cancer. And it's as much a part of life as breathing. And it's very important to have a big picture so that we can respond to events in a way that's intelligent instead of unintelligent. You know? My father-in-law is 90 years old, you know. And I went to the hospital with him. He had a coronary event, and we took him to the hospital, and they had him in the hospital for a number of days. He's a design engineer. He worked on a fusion reactor for many years at Sandia Labs. That was one of his projects. But he has a strong... He grew up in Oklahoma, so he has a kind of a hillbilly quality also. And he loves guns, you know, for example, like sporting weapons. And he's very upset because the state of New Jersey won't let him bring all his guns with him here in New Jersey. And so my friend Richard calls him Yosemite Sam, you know, and it fits, actually. Jack. His name is Jack, not Yosemite Sam, but he has a Yosemite Sam element to him. So he was in the hospital, and he's a nice man, but he can be kind of a Yosemite Sam sometimes, you know, if he doesn't think he's being treated well and so on. So we were there to make sure that he didn't, of course, want to take his guns to the hospital, but we did bring him some gun magazines to look at in the hospital. You know. And he actually has a gun. My wife came home one night, and I had gone to bed. This guy's 90 years old. He has respiratory failure, high blood pressure, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we're taking care of him. It's a great pleasure to take care of him. And I actually love him quite a bit. You know. My wife came home, and he was sitting in his chair. He was going to bed, And he doesn't wear any clothes when he goes to bed. You know. I mean, he's 90 years old, so I guess he figures who cares. You know. So he was sitting in his chair. Sometimes he just sits down. I'll fix him breakfast in the morning. I get up, I sit, I come down. I make him some yogurt with papaya, as a matter of fact. And he eats that, and he'll promptly go straight to sleep, you know, in his chair. Anyway, my wife came home, and it was like 11 o'clock at night, and he had obviously been going to bed, you know, because he had taken all his clothes off, but he sat down in his chair, and he had his rifle in his hand, which is, there's no bullets in the house, you know. But falling asleep, this 90-year-old guy's naked on his chair with a rifle in his hand. You know? And I just thought, oh, where is the camera? You know. Where was the camera when you need one? You know? So that's just a class. So he was, you know, he was in the hospital. This is the same guy in the hospital. And I went to the hospital, and I myself don't, you know, go to hospitals very often. But in this particular wing of the hospital, everybody was really sick. And there were, you could walk down the doors and you looked inside, and there were a lot of old people, you know, with tubes in their arms and so on and so on. And this is the part of, and naturally, it makes sense to have a hospital, right? It makes sense to have a mortuary and so on. But we kind of compartmentalize all of this, and in a way we pretend it doesn't exist, you know? But we really make ourselves very poor by not being attentive to like the big picture, you know? And it's possible to be well, you know, when people die, a lot of the time we'll say things like, you know, when my grandfather died, my mother, I was just a little boy, I was very close to my grandfather. He was also a hunter. I've never hunted, but he was an avid hunter, and he had a bunch of guns too, you know. Anyway, I loved him quite a bit. My grandfather and I had a good relationship. And when he died, I was quite sad, and my mother said, well, he's gone to a better place. And that's an interesting statement, in a way, in my opinion, because it doesn't necessarily help the situation. First of all, it may or may not be true, but also, why are you saying this is not a good place? You know what I mean? So he's gone to a better place, so there's something wrong with this place. It's hard for us to get the whole picture, you know, because we have kind of like cultural assumptions that get in the way, like saying, oh, he's now in a better place. That really gets in the way. It's important to have the whole picture, but it's hard to have the whole picture because we rely on culture, things we've learned growing up. We rely on ideas and language instead of our own experience, you know? Instead of our own experience. Now, Zen is all about your own, it's very easy to get confused about this, but Zen is not philosophy. Zen is not thinking. And actually, Zen is really not religion. It's really not. So when we come to Sesshin, we don't like study the sutras, right? If you want to read the sutras, by all means, they're quite interesting. But it's not what we're really up to, you know? What we're really up to is investigating reality from the standpoint of non-dualistic awareness. So, you know, actually, Zen isn't about being at peace. You know, it's nice to be at peace And actually, if you can see things as they really are, you will be at peace. You know, you will be peaceful and happy. That's a lucky break, but that's the way the universe is constructed, you know. If you see things the way they really are, and your mind is clear and free of prejudices, you'll be happy and calm, you know. But Zen isn't really about being happy and calm. In my opinion, that's not the essence of Zen. Because, you know, when your mother tells you your grandfather has gone to a better place, it might make you happy and calm, but there's a lot of problems with saying that. One of them is, maybe he hasn't gone anywhere, you know. Another is, who says this is not a good place, you know. So the thing is, just feeling better is not really what Zen is about. And some people misunderstand that. You know, they think Zen is just about getting relaxed, you know, having a positive experience. And of course, Zen is supposed to be a positive experience. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I have many positive experiences on the cushion. I did this morning, too. But the thing is, that's not like the essence of Zen. The essence of Zen is seeing things as they really are. You know, and we define that as, we define that in a special way. You know? So normally, when something happens, we, you know, try to think about what we were told or taught, or what we've been raised to believe. Or if we're like philosophers, we try to think our way through the issue. So basically, in a koan like this, you know, a duck flies by, and the teacher says, what was that? He said, it was a wild duck. And he says, is it gone? And yes. And he said, oh yeah, and then he grabs his nose and twists his nose. So it sounds like the Three Stooges or something, right? So many of these koans have this crazy element. But it's really about an event that happened. And the teacher is really saying, what just happened just now? See? So he's saying, let's investigate what's actually happening from the standpoint of non-dualistic awareness. So, if you sit on the cushion on day one of Sesshin, you have a lot of mundane thoughts. So maybe you're thinking about your job, or maybe you're thinking about your family or something. By the time you're in day two or three of Sesshin, your mind is much deeper. There are moments where there's fewer thoughts or no thoughts, where your mind becomes blank and empty. And this is extremely important. This empty state, we call it mushin. This empty state is extremely important because when you experience the moment in this empty state, it's possible to see things just as they are, without having to rely on your culture or your assumptions and beliefs. And it's hard. They're still very powerful. And it takes a long time to get good at using your mushin power to see reality for what it is. But if you keep practicing, like anything else, you get better at it. And you can become very skillful at cutting through illusion, though it takes a lot of practice. So basically, this koan, you could see as like a philosophical meditation on somebody come, you know, we all know that Buddhism is about impermanence, right? So the duck was here, and then the duck is gone. And maybe that would make us think about, it's only natural if you're working with a koan, that you would think about things in your life that were going away, and that's part of the koan. It would resonate on that level. Little by little, the koan will bring to your attention something about that's happening in your life or in the moment that you have to deal with, or you can observe and try to understand, but not with your discriminating mind, with your non-dualistic mind, your empty blank mind. And it's possible you'll notice something about reality that you wouldn't ordinarily notice. Let me give you a simple example. We say that we, you could say something like this. Right now my head is full of thoughts. My head is full of thoughts. Or you could say, my brain is buzzing like a beehive right now. You could come into Dokusan and say, you know, I'm so depressed, my head is full of thoughts right now. Or you could come in and say, my brain is buzzing like a beehive. But it's interesting, actually, you know, thoughts don't really happen in your brain. Isn't that interesting? They don't. Thoughts don't happen in your brain. That's like abstraction. If you sit down on the cushion and you are watching your breath, thoughts arise. If you look at your thoughts and say, where are my thoughts happening? Where? Actually, if you say they're happening in my brain, that's not the truth. It's just not. That's an inference, right? Based on knowledge. If you watch your thoughts come and go, what you have to say is, I think, they don't exist in space at all. There's not anywhere to it, right? In other words, like our culture says, thoughts happen in your head. But actually, if you watch your thoughts, they're really not happening in your head, right? If you watch thoughts arising, they really seem to be happening in a place that has no spatial dimension. Yeah? I hope this is making sense. Maybe it's obvious. But we say thoughts are unfolding in my head. But you know, do you know actually there are cultures in the world where they say they think the thoughts are happening in their stomach and things like that? Really? So it's just a cultural convention that we say thoughts are happening in our head, but we believe it, you know, really strongly. And actually that would be a good koan. You could just say to somebody, where are your thoughts happening? And you could sit down and say, in my head. Go into Dokusan, they're in my head. Ding, going to Dokusan. They're in my head. Ding, they're in my head. Ding. You know, if you do enough sitting, you're going to go, my God, they're not in my head. I don't know where they are. You know, I don't know where. They're just there. You know, that would be a great improvement, see? Because now what we've done is we've cut through the cultural baggage, and we've actually experienced thoughts which seem to just appear in this spaceless place, right? And it's very hard to encounter reality that way. It takes a lot of work because we normally rely on words and ideas and assumptions that aren't true. Like, it seems so obvious that thoughts happen in our heads, but they don't. They don't happen in any place, you know? And also, they don't happen in our brains. That's an inference, right? If you listen to a sound, let me see if I can make this, if you hear a sound of a cicada outside, and I say, where is that sound coming from? You could say, 20 feet away, I guess. But actually, is it true that your experience of the sound is 20 feet away? Is the sound 20 feet away, or is the sound maybe the sound does not actually have a spatial dimension? See? When I listen to that sound, my whole consciousness is just sound. So it's not 20 feet away. It's just present, totally 100%. Now, that's a difference between immediate experience and an inference. And Zen is all about trying to experience the moment without any inference. Just what's actually happening. Very difficult sometimes. What's actually happening. They asked, one time a great Zen master was asked what he had achieved after his Daikensho. And he said, I realized, you know, my eyes are horizontal and my nose is vertical. Right? And that sounds, you think, well, I didn't have to do, you know, 5 days in the sweltering heat to know that. But actually, that kind of consciousness is very difficult to achieve. You know, where is the sound of the cicada? Where? If you listen carefully with an empty mind, you just become totally 100% sound. There's no where, yeah? I think. Please feel free to let me know if that's not the case. But this is what Zen is all about. It's not about figuring things out. There is a kind of existential dimension to Zen, you know. So some koans really are about human relationships. But even with those, it's our method is not to figure things out. This is not a criticism of anybody, by the way. I mean, I spent the first 10 years of my practice learning how not to figure things out, you know, but how to observe what's actually happening. But I can save you a lot of time if you notice that there's this difference between the immediate experience and the so-called reality of our culture. So even things like the body, you know, we have a image of the body. You know, for example, you might say, let me give you an example. I started doing Zen training about 30 some years ago in 1976 or 77. And I had read some books by D.T. Suzuki on Zen, and I read some books on Tibet by a guy named Lobsang Rampa, who said that Tibetan lamas can communicate telepathically. Lobsang Rampa, his books really sold very well for many years, and you would meet people who said, oh, have you heard of Lobsang Rampa? Oh, yes. Yeah. And he said that monks in Tibet can communicate telepathically. He said that they travel on giant kites, you know, and things like this, just incredible whoppers, you know. But at one time, nobody had been to Tibet, and it was just this land of magic and mystery. So I read these books, and I thought, wow, this is so cool, you know. So anyway, I had also read books called The Teachings of Don Juan. Actually, it should be Don Juan, Juan, Don Juan, not the teachings of the great European lover, but the teachings of the mysterious Yaqui shaman, Don Juan. Okay. So Don Juan was a Yaqui shaman who could jump off of cliffs with his magical powers. And a young anthropologist named Carlos Castaneda became his student. And they dropped a lot of peyote together. So anyway, I had read all these books, and I was ready to be initiated into mysteries without, you know, secret mysteries. And my teacher gave me a breath koan, Genki Roshi. And he said, I want you to watch the breath and see what happens with the breath. And I was so disappointed because I wanted the secret initiations, you know. And I would just sit there and watch the breath and think, okay, you know, I'm done. Enough said. And this went on actually for quite a few years. I was unable to just be present in the moment and watch the breath. I surrounded the event of my breathing with all of these ideas and concepts. I had worked out a whole philosophy of the breath, which I would try to share with Genki Roshi, but he wouldn't allow me to. He would just ring the bell when I started talking. I wrote beautiful poetry. I tried many different things about the breath and to communicate the depth of my enlightenment to Genki Roshi. But it took me a long time to just be present with the breath. And then, the most amazing thing happened. One day I was sitting on the cushion feeling inferior and like a Zen failure. And everybody else was passing their koans. It seemed like every time they went into the Dokusan room, they'd pass their koan. And I was like the guy with the dunce cap on in the corner, because I couldn't pass my koan after years. It's just this is like the baby koan, right? Breath perception. I should be able to pass this. This is the simplest koan. But it took me many years, and I never did pass it, by the way, formally. But I was sitting one day in working on the Mu Koan, and I was watching my breath, and I suddenly realized that my breath wasn't coming out my nose, it was coming out my forehead. My breath seemed to be coming out like through my eyes, even though my eyes were closed, and the area around my forehead. And it hit me, this is about experience. I took biology, I remember a little tiny bit of my biology, The O2 comes in and it goes out as CO2. And I used to know what those little hairs in your lungs were called and how it got into your blood and so on. And so I knew, basically when I breathed, I had to be breathing through my nose. But, experientially, that's not how it is. Sometimes when I would breathe, it felt like it was coming out my forehead or my eyes. And sometimes it would feel like it was coming out, my hands even. And if I had just gone into Genki Roshi and said, the darndest thing is happening, my breath is coming out my eyes, he would have gone, oh, good, But I didn't understand what Zen is about. It doesn't matter what you think should be happening. It doesn't matter what is supposed to happen or what people have told you should happen. It's what's actually happening right now. And what is happening is something to investigate, But reporting, this spirit of investigating what's actually happening is really the essence of Zen. So when we're working with a koan, the koan is actually kind of like tempting us to be philosophers. So we tend to try to figure things out using the discriminating mind. So in this case, in the case of this koan, we see, of course, the duck is here and then the duck is flown away. So this is all about impermanence. And you could come into Dokusan and say, it's all impermanent. See? But actually, that wouldn't be a very good answer to the koan. It's not a bad answer. It's not bad, but it's not very deep because it's still in the realm of words and ideas. A deeper answer would be like, sitting on the cushion and watching your breath until you go into mushin, and then try to notice something is flying away right now. What is it? See, here's a big hint. Every koan is talking about something that's present all the time, every moment, without exception. We may not notice it yet. We may not have noticed it yet, but it's there in the moment. So it's your moment. So your moment's going to be different from my moment. And your moment might have a lot of things that my moment doesn't have, and vice versa. But as you're sitting on the cushion and you're going flown away, there's something in every moment that's flying away. What is it? See? And then you start watching the moments flying away. See? Now this can be very deep experience, you know, very, very profound experience. And you're watching with your non-discriminating mind, and your mind is very still and blank. And you'll begin to see, it's like you're seeing, you know, if you look through a telescope, you know, you look up at the moon, and it's just a disc with a little face in it, or a rabbit or something. Yeah. Some people think there's a rabbit. You look through a telescope, and you can see, like, craters. If you have a really good telescope, you can see, you know, all kinds of stuff up there. You know, if you look through a microscope, you know, you have a drop of water, it's just a drop of water. You make a slide out of it, look through the microscope, and there's little amoebas in there, you know, so on. This is how it works with koan practice too, right? It's like you're increasing the magnification. So when the mind is normally pulled along by thoughts and fears and anxieties, you know, a lot of Zen practice is just working through all that stuff. It takes 2 or 3 days of a sesshin so before you can start seeing reality without all of this junk in your way, all of these screens. You know, normally we just are so distracted, we can't see reality, you know, can see reality hardly at all. It's really a miracle, you know, that we're able to function the way we do, because people are normally like just so distracted. So you come to sesshin, it takes 2 or 3 days before the mind begins to get still, and you'll have these moments where your mind is blank, and you can work on the koan without, you know, and let the koan act like the koan is pointing you towards something. It's saying, look at something about the moment that's like this. See, and when your mind is still and blank, and you look, you begin to notice, it's like looking through a telescope or looking through a microscope. You begin to notice all this stuff that you didn't see before. And some of it can be quite powerful, so quite moving, quite beautiful, quite terrifying, you know. But it's really there. It's really there. Normally people don't understand it because they don't have the mental stability to see it. Or they're just like hysterical all the time and they can't concentrate long enough to notice it. Or they put too much trust in the words of their culture, which are often baloney, you know. So, you know, if somebody asked you, where do your thoughts come, where are your thoughts? You might sit down on the cushion and you might try to think it through. Thoughts are in my brain, thoughts are in my head. You know, thoughts arise from a question, you know, or something else. But if you watch with a calm mind, you notice, my God, my thoughts don't have any location in space at all. You know, I don't know where they are, but they're not in space. See, that would be really quite an achievement. You begin to see reality as it actually is. And another one is like this, you know, every day we get up and we take care of the self, right? I do too. I get up. I think, what would make Kurt happy today? You know, I'll have, you know, breakfast, you know. And I go down, a cup of tea, that would be delicious, you know. All day we're taking care of the self, but what is the self, actually? You know, if you try to answer it, you try to answer it philosophically, you can say, well, the self is, you know, the part of me that thinks. Or you might say, the self is my body. You know, I'm the embodied consciousness. This is what philosophers say. But the Zen way would be to sit down on the cushion and enter Mushin and say, where does self, when do I become aware of myself as a self? You know, when does this sense of self arise? And you might notice that it's there sometimes, and it's not there sometimes, and so on and so on. And where's it coming from? So Zen is all about, I mean, of course, if you practice Zen, I promise you'll feel much better. You'll be much happier. Because actually, you know, when people are in the moment, as it actually is, they are happy. Even though it doesn't quite match their expectations, the moment is really our like true home. It's our true self. I've talked about this before, you know, but you know, when my father got a diagnosis of cancer, he was very upset. Everybody in my family has cancer, just about. And my father's mother died of cancer, all his aunts died of cancer. My father died of cancer, my mother died of cancer. It's like, but my father somehow thought he wasn't going to get cancer. And he had just retired. He was 65 when he retired, and he was 69 when he died. And he was so pissed off about it, you know. And he was so unhappy because he felt so cheated, you know. And he was like depressed because he was dying. Now, I mentioned that, I've mentioned before that, you know, at one time in our Zen center in Seattle, a friend of Genki Roshi's, a Roshi from Japan, was visiting. I guess they had been friends, and the guy knew he was on the way out, and he was visiting his old friends. And so he went to see Genki, which is a great, you know, see, so different from my dad, you know. My dad was just brooding and unhappy. This guy thought, well, I'm on the way out. Why don't I go see the people I love? You know, so he went to see Genki. And he was staying at the Zen center, our Zen center, and he was dying. You know? But he was such an animated person. It was so impressive. I was so impressed. This was long before my dad died, but I was just so impressed by how he was embracing this whole thing. You know, he was just totally present with what was happening. And he was, I mean, we're all going to die, right? I mean, you could go out screaming in agony or bitter. But, you know, actually, he saw things very clearly, you know? I mean, I have cancer. This is going to happen. You know, and he and Genki would, you know, do calligraphy and they had a ball. They'd be laughing. I couldn't understand their jokes, you know. But they clearly, they drank sake together, you know. They had a good time. Sometimes this guy would get very sick. He'd have to go lie down. And he didn't have a lot of energy. He slept a lot. But a different attitude, right? So I think that having the whole picture makes us happy. And it's a really wonderful way to live, and it all starts with this method, you could say, the method of Zen is to just notice what's actually happening. And it's very different, as I say, from what we think is happening, what we wish would be happening, what people have told us is happening. So this, I wanted to read you the story of the on which this koan is based. This is in the Mumonkan that I just read. It's called Hyakujo and a Wild Duck. Hyakujo and a Wild Duck. But actually, in Chinese, Yakujo is Baijiang. Zen master Wai Hai of Baijiang Mountain in Hongzhou was a native of Changle in Fuzhou, a son of the Wang family. When he was a boy, he accompanied his mother to a temple where they bowed to an image of Buddha. He pointed to the image of Buddha and asked his mother, "Who is this?" Great, he asked a question with the questioning mind. I'll stop editorializing, I'll just read the story. He pointed to the image of Buddha and he asked his mother, "Who is this?" His mother said, "Buddha." The boy said, "He is not different in form than a man. I want to be a Buddha too." When Baizhang was a young man, he left behind the dusts of worldly life and practiced the three studies of discipline, concentration, and wisdom. That's like a basic foundation of Zen practice. I'll stop there. He studied with Ma Zhu and served as an attendant. Whenever the donors made offerings of vegetarian food, as soon as Baizhang lifted the lid of the bowl, Ma Zhu would pick up a fried cake and show it to the assembly, and he would say, "What is this?" This happened again and again. One day, as Baizhang was accompanying Ma Zhu on a walk, they saw a flock of wild ducks flying by. Ma Zhu said, "What are those?" Baizhang said, "Wild ducks." Ma Zhu said, "Where have they gone?" Baizhang said, "They've flown by." Ma Zhu then twisted Baizhang's nose, and Baizhang groaned in pain. Ma Zhu said, "Do you still think it's flown away?" At these words, Baizhang had an awakening. Baizhang returned to the attendants' quarters, crying loudly. Another of the attendants asked him, "Are you thinking of your parents? Are you lonely for your parents?" Baizhang said, "No." "Did somebody scold you?" Baizhang said, "No." "Then why are you crying?" "My nose was twisted by our teacher and it still hurts." The other attendant said, "Was there some misunderstanding?" Baizhang said, "Go ask our teacher yourself." The attendant went and asked Ma Zhu, "Was there some misunderstanding with attendant Baizhang? He is back in the attendants' quarters crying. I hope you will explain this for me, Master." Ma Zhu said, "He understands this. He's not really crying because his nose was twisted. He understands this. Go ask him." When the other attendant got back to their quarters, he said to Baizhang, "Our master said you understand, and he told me to ask you." Baizhang started laughing out loud. The other attendant said, "A little while ago you were crying, now you're laughing." Baizhang said, "A little while ago I was crying, and now I'm laughing." The other attendant was at a loss. The next day, when Ma Zhu went to the teacher's seat in the Dharma hall, as soon as the congregation had gathered, Baizhang came forward and rolled up Ma Zhu's mat. Ma Zhu then left the seat. Immediately after, Baizhang came up to Ma Zhu's private quarters. Ma Zhu said, "Just now, why did you roll up the mat before I had preached the Dharma?" Baizhang said, "Yesterday I got my nose twisted by you, Master, and it hurt." Ma Zhu said, "Where were you keeping your mind yesterday?" Baizhang said, "Today my nose no longer hurts." Ma Zhu said, "You deeply understand yesterday's business." Baizhang bowed and withdrew. Another time, when Baizhang was standing in attendance on Ma Zhu, Ma Zhu's eyes fell on the whisk hanging from the corner of the meditation bench. Baizhang said, "Do you function merged with this or detached from this?" In other words, when you act, are you one with the whisk or separate from the whisk? Ma Zhu said, "In the future, when you open your mouth, what will you use to teach people?" Baizhang took the whisk and held it upright. Matsu said, will you function detached from this or merged with this? Baijiang hung the whisk back up where it had been before. Matsu gave an awesome shout, which left Baijiang deaf for 3 days. Not long, that's a big move, right? Not long after that, when Baijiang was staying on Da Zhong Mountain, his dwelling place was on a steep cliff, so it was called Baijiang. Students flocked to him from all over. One day, Baijiang said to the assembly, the Buddha Dharma is not a small thing. In the past, I was shouted at by Matsu, and I was deaf for 3 days. Well, all of this sounds crazy, and unless you understand what they're doing. You know, this is like asking about investigating reality, right? So a duck flies by, and Matsu said, look, be in deep mushin, and tell me, is the duck gone or not? Now, normally you say, of course it's gone. Are you sure? Investigate in deep mushin. When he twists Baijiang's nose, Baijiang has an awakening experience. But they keep going. They keep asking new questions. So the next day, Baijiang rolls up a mat, and Matsu says, why did you do that? And so on and so on. And then they start asking about the relationship between the past and the present. That happened to you yesterday. What happened to yesterday? And there's a whisk hanging down, and hanging off of a pole. A whisk was a ceremonial whisk that teachers used. He said, look, when you use a whisk, are you one with the whisk, or are you separate from the whisk? Now, that's actually a great koan. When you use a broom, when you sweep with a broom, are you one with the broom, or are you separate from the broom? Don't think about it. Investigate. Be in deep mushin. And then, get up and sweep and see what happens when you look at sweeping with your empty, blank mind. Are you one with the broom or separate from the broom? Okay? So this is the Zen way. It's really beautiful. This is Zen reality. It's not religion. It's not philosophy. It's a lot like science, but it's science with the non-dual mind. How do things actually happen? If the world really is one, all the things we believe are a bunch of crap, really. If the world is really one life, then so much of what we think is pure baloney. So we have to start, rebuilding our understanding from scratch. We start with the breath. And we notice this breath does some strange things, We notice there's this emptiness there behind the breath, and when we try to become one with that emptiness, strange things happen. And from there on, it's just like this great adventure. It's really great. It's always interesting. It's always new. There's always more to investigate, and it's always amazing, in my opinion. It's really something else. Just sweeping can be like an earth-shattering experience. Really, try it. Go into deep mushin and then sweep and see what you find out. Anyway, everybody's doing a wonderful job. Last night when people came in to Dokusan, it's very clear everybody's working with their koans. Sometimes when we work with our koans, we get tangled up. That's part of it too. Have to work our way through. But everybody's making a beautiful effort. So just keep going, full speed ahead, okay?